Thank you very much. Thank you, Gerard. And thank you for those of you who invited me to speak here. This is, I think, a very important kind of issue that we're going to be talking about for the next couple of days. My slant on this is related to this last book that Gerard mentioned, The New Sociological Imagination, which is deliberately entitled to resonate with C. Wright Mills' book from 1959. One of the things that the book confronts is what exactly is distinctive about sociology. I think one of the interesting things that Gerard mentioned in his opening remarks to this conference was the fact that from a certain kind of standpoint, in terms of material resources and demand, sociology looks very good. There is actually a lot of money for research grants into areas in which sociologists work. There's a lot of demand for courses that sociologists teach. But it's not at all clear whether this adds up to a demand for a discipline called sociology. Okay? And it seems to me that this is kind of the issue that, well, at least the issue that I'm confronting in the book, and I think, in a sense, is the issue we ought to be focused on here, namely whether there is something distinctive called sociology that is in a way, and I understand sociology for purposes of this argument as the most general social science where one wants to make a distinction between the social sciences and on the one hand the humanities and on the other hand the natural sciences. Okay, so this is what I think is sort of up for grabs here at this point. You know, if you recall Frank's talk this morning, Frank Verini's talk, he was sort of hinting at ways in which the social was being sort of cannibalized. And he was getting at a couple of interesting directions where the cannibalization is coming from. And again, you might say one, broadly speaking, is coming from the humanistic end, and with the idea of the social and indeed any kind of collective, long-term, human-based project being deconstructed. Okay. On the other hand, at the same time, a lot of this kind of traditional terrain that sociologists are concerned about, so if you think of, you know, the sort of popular growth areas like issues having to do with the family, with crime, with health, and so forth, they are gradually being taken over, especially among younger generation of people, by people with a very strong interest in biomedical sciences, biotechnology, and, you know, what one might broadly call the socio-biological sciences, including evolutionary psychology and things of that kind. Okay. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is that both the humanities and the natural sciences, the way they've been sort of encroaching on sociology's turf, has in fact been very much in the guise of interdisciplinarity, for example, both of them, and whereas social scientists are seen as kind of hidebound and harking back largely to a kind of 19th century holy trinity of Marx, Weber, and Durkheim. And so from that standpoint, especially if you're a younger person and you're not already invested in having read all the great classics of social theory, it does look a little puzzling why it is in this era where we've got all these amazing new phenomena to study and all these areas of the world that we've never looked at before that we're constantly teaching Marx, Weber, and Durkheim and thinking that the measure of advance in social theory is, you know, how can you pick and mix them in some combination? So, you know, for someone who's not already invested in this, social science looks like not to have, as it were, the equipment to deal with the issues of social life that face us today. And I really think that we have to take this point seriously. This is not just a matter of people not knowing what sociology really is, blah, 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 but there's a sense in which there is a kind of mismatch between the kind of theoretical orientation that we come in with, especially as sociologists, and the kind of world that we're facing now. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, from a standpoint of, you know, theoretical resources, we're kind of easy pickings for other disciplines. Okay? And the New Sociological Imagination, this book of mine, basically kind of confronts this issue head on, and in particular takes very seriously the kind of threat, and I think it is a threat if you're a social scientist, coming from the biological side. I think that is a real issue, okay? And it cannot be reduced to simple-minded, you know, fears of biological reductionism, because things have gotten very sophisticated and very complicated, and there's a sense in which we really have not come to grips with this. Now, one of the things that I do in this book, which sort of gets us to the business of how British sociology fits into this, is, of course, the sociological tradition as we understand it normally has had a kind of running dialogue, often not very productive, with Darwinism. okay? And with genetics, of course. I mean, already we've heard in this conference a few mentions of eugenics and so forth, and people who we would have no trouble calling social scientists or even sociologists have been very much involved with these things over the course of history, okay? And this has been especially true in the English-speaking world. The reason why I'm stressing Britain over the United States on this matter has a lot to do with the degree to which concerns about what Beveridge, the architect of the welfare state in this country, called social biology, was very much a sort of national frontline issue to which there was a lot of concentrated state effort devoted, which of course gave us the welfare state of the post-war period. In the United States, to be sure, there was an enormous amount of discussion and dealings with Darwinism and genetics in all its forms in the 20th century, but was very diffuse and moved in many different directions. If you think about in the American context, the kinds of people who in fact engaged with Darwinism in the early 20th century, one would think, for example, of George Herbert Mead and the pragmatist tradition, right? One would also think of Robert Park and his notions of ecology and so forth for understanding neighborhoods and why they get segregated the way they do. You would also think of William Graham Sumner, who is probably most, closely associated with social Darwinism as a justification for a kind of laissez-faire capitalist ideology in early 20th century America. And also on the eugenics side, you would get someone like Edward Ross, E.A. Ross, who was for a long time one of the main figures in sociology, especially social psychology in the United States, was involved in some famous tenure disputes and so forth, but was basically a populist eugenicist at the end of the day, and was using kind of eugenics-inspired arguments for making arguments against having too many immigrants coming into the country, for example. Okay, now these are many different ways from a sociological standpoint that you can take the legacy of Darwinism and genetics. And in the United States, they went in all these many different directions associated with politics across the political spectrum. So it wasn't necessarily a right-wing project by any means. Ross thought of himself as kind of a socialist. Okay, and of course, as you know, until the rise of Nazi Germany, most of the eugenicists were people on the left. All right, and so you've got this kind of very wide but diffuse engagement with biology in the American sociological tradition. Whereas in Britain, what I would argue is that it was much more focused. And in that sense, I think provides much more guidance and thinking now, especially in a period where we're getting greater genetic and other biological information about people, creating whole new forms of social divisions, class structures, and so forth. And there needs to be, even though we live in a period where the state seems to be declining, we nevertheless need some kind of general, comprehensive, organized way of dealing with this. Okay, and this is one of the virtues of the establishment of the welfare state in Britain and the other European countries in the 20th century, was it brought to bear a kind of collective intelligence, right, to take all of this information that was being learned about people and how they were living and what kinds of backgrounds they had and so forth, and try to do something whereby one would literally say the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Okay, and it seems to me at the end of the day that is what the sociological project is devoted to. Right, is to some kind of construction of a whole that is greater than the sum of the parts. Okay, this is quite an important point from the standpoint of the engagement with biology, because those of you who are familiar with the sociobiological literature and the evolutionary psychology literature, when these literatures deal with social life, they usually operate on the assumption that everything is basically built up from the family. Everything is built up from kin structure. And if you want to organize larger social, or understand how larger social groups manage to maintain themselves, it's going to be some extension, often some very complicated extension of kin relations. And so one can come up with issues like typical altruism and so forth, where you sort of extend beyond kin boundaries and so forth. But at the end of the day, there is this fundamental belief among people who are biologically inclined that the ultimate, the natural social unit, as it were, is the family, and any kind of stable unit has to be, in some sense, built upon it. Now, it seems to me that from the history of social science, if there is a lesson to be told from the history of social science, it's basically a denial of this thesis, right? That, namely, the kinds of social entities that really matter that really, in fact, as it were, bring us above, you know, what animals do spontaneously, are those that in many respects go against the default tendencies of family relations and intergenerational relations. So, for example, when we talk about distinctions between ascribed and achieved status and so forth, right, there's a sense in which these kinds of distinctions are marking a kind of biological versus non- or even anti-biological form of social reproduction. And if we talk about larger scale social entities where one's membership is secured not by who you were born to, but rather by having to go through formal examination, whether it be examination to get into university or examination to become a citizen of a country, right? We are talking distinctive social entities that make a concerted, systematic, long-term effort to break the kind of default patterns that would otherwise be maintained in a purely biological understanding of society. Okay? And so these kinds of artificial entities, the kinds of things that Max Weber talks a lot about in his Sociology of Law as corporations, where we go back to the Middle Ages, about the universitas, which included universities and churches and guilds, and then later on included the state, and then finally in the 19th century the word corporation gets used for business firms. Okay, that these entities are, in a sense, these are the main social entities of social science. They are the ones whose long-term continuation, whose ability to actually deliver benefits that go beyond what individuals could do by themselves or through their spontaneous association as family members or friends, those are the things that distinguish us from other animals. Okay? And it is interesting that all of this biological research that we see now is trying to colonize social life. What it typically, when you look at what they say about the state, for example, they basically, I mean, a great example of what I'm talking about here comes from Luigi Cavalli-Sforza, who is a geneticist, a person who's very much involved with the Human Genetic Diversity Project, which some of you may know about, which basically tries to map out the genetic differences among the different types of peoples of the world. And when he writes about the origins of large-scale social entities, he definitely thinks everything's an extension of the family and the clan. I mean, this could be Lewis Henry Morgan in the late 19th century, really. Okay? It's as if nothing's happened since 1870 in this guy's mind. And then, and here's the pernicious part, when he then looks at the failure of welfare states and socialism over the past quarter century, and what's the reason? They're not natural, right? They attempt, in a futile way, ultimately, to defy this kind of logic, whereby the only kinds of stable social entities are going to be the ones that are extensions of kin relations. And that the failure of socialism, the failure of the welfare state, is a testimony how, as it were, there is an ultimate biological barrier that social scientists up to this time have refused to take seriously. Okay? So this is a quite important point, because what these biologists, you know, so if you deal with one of these biologists and you say, well, what about all these big social entities? What about all these amazing things that sociologists study about? And they say, well, look, they're all falling apart. They're all failing. They cost so much money to maintain, they don't make any sense. You know, it's like sacrificing your young to the gods when you put more money into taxes. And in fact, some of these people talk this way. Okay, so from that standpoint, and the religion, and the analogy with religion here is not arbitrary, okay? Because if you look at E.O. Wilson, right, the father of sociobiology, in his book Consilience in 1998, he compares sociology to theology. Right, that ends up justifying all kinds of superstitious beliefs and attitudes toward the world, you know, like, let's say, paying lots of taxes to redistribute income as if that's going to actually raise people. Okay, and so he says basically what in this new consilient universal science, which Wilson sees as a kind of combination of the humanities and the natural sciences doing an end run around the social sciences, right? So we eliminate the social sciences as kind of the theological residue of science. And then the humanists, who've always been talking about human nature, the older ones at least, right, they get together with the biologists and it all gets explained. Okay? And then sociology and all these other fields that, you know, talk about you know, distinctiveness of humanity and so forth, they're all just seen as a kind of the last gasp of theology, which also, right, especially if we talk about the Judeo-Christian or Islamic tradition, privileges human beings among all forms of creation as well. And you see this happening. You know, this kind of argument is not just is not just unique to Wilson. You see Peter Singer, who's got a book called A Darwinian Left, which is to replace Marx with Darwin as the foundation of the left, and it argues the same kind of line as well, that Marx had this kind of superstitiously almost kind of view that humans were like gods that could remake the world and stuff of this kind. So this is kind of the threat, all right, that I think we have to be very much alive to here in terms of the future of social science. Because it is quite easy now, at least for me, to imagine that social science some intellectual historian writing 100 years from now could say, social science was indeed a kind of secular theology that existed, let's say, from the end of the Enlightenment to the end of the Cold War. Right? And that was, as it were, when the fantasy, the flirtation with socialism existed. And that basically defines the period of social science. And one of the things that you see now, of course, is that the more methodologically inclined aspects of social science, you think about various kinds of decision theory, more formalized methods from economics, right, experimental methods from psychology, they're migrating, right? They're migrating. We're talking rats and sinking ships here, right? There's a migration taking place, right? These methodologists who are kind of ideologically light, they can just move, okay? And in a sense, right, from the standpoint of the people who are trying to forge this kind of larger social biological science, right, it looks like these are really just the salvageable bits of social science. These kind of quantified, formalized kinds of techniques that, in a sense, are indifferent to the substance they cover. So you can have a decision theoretic account of human beings interacting with each other or genes interacting with each other in the genome, right? You can do it either way. You don't have to be committed to some kind of ontology of the social for this. Okay? And so one could see that happening too. So all these issues are there. Now, let's go back to Britain for a moment. One of the things that's interesting about Britain, as I've been pointing out, is that there is a real engagement from the beginning, from the 19th century onward, with the biological dimension of social life, with intention at applying to governance. Whether we're talking about Francis Galton and his ideas about eugenics as a way of doing away with the House of Lords, right, or we're talking about Beveridge with his ideas of social biology in the 1930s and 40s, we have a constant engagement with the biological dimension of social life as being kind of the raw material that, in a sense, needs to be organized in order to make any kind of national progress. What you don't have is a kind of stigmatization of the biological the way you do, let's say, in Germany. Okay, I mean, one of the interesting things about the establishment of social science in Germany in the early 20th century, and one of the reasons why even the word sociology was a bit not used favorably, was there was this concern, and I think it's a concern that we still have a lot today as social scientists, where we want to kind of keep our distance from issues that have very sensitive political consequences. We don't want to be contaminated by policymakers, and we don't want to be dictated by them, but also we don't want our work, in a way, sort of colored by it so that we can't actually see what's really there. So what happens is one then puts up certain boundaries about the kinds of issues one will not deal with. And so when the social scientists broke apart from the social policy people in Germany in the early 20th century, and here people like Max Weber and Turnies and the people we call sociologists are part of this breakaway group, right? They're not going to talk about race, they're not going to talk about feminism, they're not going to talk about socialism, none of these things are going to be part of the agenda. Right? They're not going to say how any of their stuff bears on those kinds of politically sensitive issues. Okay? One is going to carve out the social space in a way that one doesn't have to deal with them. So there's no obvious, there's a kind of very sharp boundary between what's relevant to scholarship and relevant to policymakers. Now, in Britain, this sharp distinction did not exist. Did not exist in this way. Okay. Now, you've got two kinds of strands, and this is one of the things that I talk about in the book with regard to British sociology. There are two kinds of strands, and in a sense they're represented by this business of sociology and social policy as somehow separable. Okay. In the book, I use the London School of Economics as a kind of convenient site for discussing this, because there's a sense in which you might get a theoretical sides of this come out very nicely there. On the one hand, you have the, you know, what was the Department of Social Theory and Institutions and so forth that comes out of L.T. Hobhouse and was probably really made very important institutionally by Morris Ginsburg and T.H. Marshall and people of that kind, okay? And That's on one side. And the other side is the side that's represented by Beveridge and the social biological people, often people with a kind of institutional economics background who are very interested in the collection analysis of statistics about people's lives, and in particular very interested in issues of class mobility intergenerationally, which becomes a very important kind of theme in British empirical research in the post-war period. And you have these two strands kind of developing from the early 20th century onward in British sociology. And if you read Ralph Dahrendorf's book on the history of the LSE, you get a very good sense of the ways in which these things meshed and did not mesh very well. Because basically, these two strands represent, you might say, a kind of humanistic versus a more scientific orientation to the same subject matter. And what the same subject matter is, and this is where I think the point of social science comes in the British context, is on the one hand, there is a pretty complete across-the-board acceptance of evolution. There is an acceptance of evolutionary biology as being basically true or true enough for purposes that we're not going to spend time arguing against it, okay? But on the other hand, say that what marks us as human beings, what marks us in our humanity, is our ability to organize and in many respects to turn back these tendencies. That is to say, to recognize the tendencies for what they are, right? So you think about the original eugenicist like Francis Galton. He says, look, there's this tendency for accumulative advantage to take place. So you get one ancestor who does something very important in their lifetime, and then all the rest of their offspring benefit from it, even if they're total losers. Hence, House of Lords, right? And what you want to do, rather, is to reward genuine achievement instead. But you can't actually do that unless you see, as it were, the magnitude of the problem. And the magnitude of the problem forces you to address the biological side of the issue up front and then figure out ways by which you can correct it. You know, and then, of course, one can have a lot of political debate about the modes of correction. For example, killing aristocrats, making it impossible for them to reproduce, taxing them their brains out. I mean, there are a lot of possibilities here, right? And all have their attractions. But the point is, that's where the active political debate comes in, right? But it's against the general framework, right, where you operate on the assumption, yes, human beings have this biological character, but because we're human beings, we don't just have it. We also have the ability to transcend that in some way. Now, transcending it isn't just theology. It isn't just wishing it away. It isn't just spirituality. But rather, it's a certain form of understanding the nature of the raw phenomena we're given, you know, being human beings distributed across Britain the way we are, and then trying to figure out how we can get somewhere else with that. Okay? And that is the thing that seems to me has been very crucial in terms of the import of the British sociological tradition. An acknowledgement of the biological evolutionary side, but at the same time, not taking that as somehow indicating that's just the way things have to be. So a kind of resistance of the laissez-faire mentality. Right, a resistance of the laissez-faire mentality. Now, this becomes a very important point to raise here, because when we do the history of sociology and we talk about the British contribution, first of all, it's rarely even acknowledged that there's a British contribution. That's the first point. But if you look at, let's say, books that tend to divide up the history of sociology in terms of national tradition, I think of Donald Levine's book, Visions of the Sociological Tradition, there's a chapter on Britain. Always a chapter on Britain, if there is one, happens in the beginning, you know, kind of like, you know, it got lost. It's like a pre-sociological, right? It's all about Adam Smith and David Hume and, you know, and spontaneously self-organizing whatnots in Scotland, you know. And it sort of assimilates all of this to John Stuart Mill, Bentham, Herbert Spencer, and they're all kind of generic, utilitarian kind of guys. Right, who are in a little sense too individualistic to really kind of get a real grip on the social. That's kind of what the verse is on British sociology, right? And then, you know, thank God Anthony Giddens went across to the continent in 1980 and now we've got life, right? So this is kind of the story of British sociology. This is a big mistake. It is probably of all of the stereotypings that one might do of the national tradition, and one can imagine like in a stereotype story of the French and the Germans and so forth. This is the worst, right? The one that's done on the British is the worst because it basically fails to recognize the extent to which, you know, that in fact there has been serious engagement with the social, not only as an entity ontologically, but also as something that is being organized and constructed. And here I think it becomes very important to distinguish clearly in our minds between the utilitarian tradition of Bentham and Mill, which was in that business, it was trying to do that, from people like Herbert Spencer. I mean, when people think about, okay, who is the founder of sociology in Britain, they always think of Herbert Spencer because he used the word a lot. Okay? But for my money, this man's not a sociologist, right? He doesn't have a sociological bone in his body. Largely because he accepts a kind of laissez-faire attitude. He's a guy who would be very comfortable with the evolutionary psychology and the sociobiology that we have rising today. And for him, there'd be no problem. There wouldn't be a need for any kind of autonomous discipline or set of disciplines called social science, right? It would just be the application of kind of organic laws such as they are to human beings as opposed to other species in other environments. That would be Herbert Spencer. So Herbert Spencer would be very comfortable with what's happening now. But Mill and Bentham would not be, especially Mill. Okay. And here it's unfortunate that we do not sufficiently see John Stuart Mill, who I think everybody realizes is a very complicated figure, and certainly someone who, as it were, managed to work his way out of a kind of, from a liberal perspective, into a kind of welfare state mentality. Okay, we're in a sense in which that the expansion of liberty and the expansion of equality can go together. Okay, that they are not trade-offs, the way other people were thinking in the 19th century. Okay, and the thing I think the reason why Mill is not included as part of the canon of the sociological tradition and not seen as kind of the fundamental figure for British sociology that he is that he hated the word sociology. And this is again, how history is, people, that it's always a little turn of fate can end up screwing everything up. Sociology, those of you who are etymologically sensitive, know sociology is a barbarism, right? It's half Latin, half Greek in its construction. Socius is Latin, logos is Greek, and anyone like John Stuart Mill who knew Greek when he was in the womb, right, would not just take this. So what did he call? He said, Auguste Comte, who he spent all his life corresponding with. You may know that Mill was Comte's main publicist in Britain, and he was promoting the whole sociological positivism thing in Britain. But he didn't like the word. He thought the word was dead, and so he preferred ethology. And you don't happen with that word, okay? But that was Mill's word. That was Mill's word, okay? And now what happened there was that, as people were... when people do the history of this stuff and they look at who's affiliated to who and so forth, these words matter. These words matter. And the fact that Mill very did not like this word sociology and talked about ethology kind of really pulled them out of the tradition. Okay? And this is a big mistake. By the way, this is something that I think has happened more and more in recent years. You may know about Halsey's book on the history of sociology in Britain. If you look in the back of the book, they got a list of the most highly cited sociologists for various decades of the late 20th century. Mill's number two in 1950. In sociology journals, most highly cited, number two most highly cited figure, after Morris Ginsberg, who owns the journal, right? as a lesson to journal. So Mill's number two. Now that's pretty impressive, okay? And what I would want to maintain is that there's a sense in which people kind of knew Mill was involved, okay? People knew Mill was involved, but I think as we move into the 60s and 70s, and there's an interesting story which I don't have a full grasp on about how the field gets canonized in terms of the way history gets told, because it's interesting, Marx, Weber, and Durkheim only start to make it into the top five of citations in British sociology in 1980. In 1980, because if you look at 60 and 70, you'd find Parsons and Merton. And then Marx, Weber, Durkheim, much lower down on the scale. So it was first Americanized, and then it got Europeanized, and then Europeanized, as it got Europeanized, retrospectively you bring back in all the European founders. Okay? And this is an interesting pattern, okay? Because, one thing you would say is that in the 60s and 70s, when people wanted to talk about Weberian, Durkheimian, whatever idea, they'd cite Parsons or Merton. Right, they cite the Americanized versions of it. They don't disaggregate them. Right? Whereas in the 80s, and Giddens has a lot to do with this, this changes, okay? But the point is the whole British side of this story disappears even within Britain. I mean, a striking thing about the most highly cited people in British sociology as you go through the decades from the 1950s onward is how the British people just drop out. Okay? And so if you look at the list now, it's just a lot of continental critters. And this is quite interesting. It's quite an interesting point, right? And in fact, if one wants to say you know, how does British sociology figure today on the world social science scene, I would say, with all due respect, it is a colonial battleground, basically, for continental philosophies to fight their wars, right? Because this is the place where the Germans and the French fight it out for a significant market, whereas in their home countries, they've got their markets to themselves and their own internal competition. Britain's the country where they all come and they can fight, and because Britain has a large export market to former colonies and things like this, that there's a lot at stake fighting the battle here from the standpoint of continental theorists. But what that means is that Britain just becomes a kind of placeholder. It becomes just a sort of transit point. And I think this is very unfortunate, okay? This is very unfortunate, given the kind of rich history that this country has had in trying to deal with the relationship between social science and social policy, that is in fact very relevant for the kinds of times that we're moving into now, where Darwinism is becoming very important again, where genetics is taking a sort of front row seat in all kinds of arenas where previously this was thought to have no kind of relevance. And here, Britain is in fact historically world leader in that area, at the policy level and at the social science level, okay? And it's unfortunate that we're not really kind of talking about that more or trying to incorporate that, you know, especially in our theorizing. Because one of the things about social theory, whatever else you might want to say about it, is it's the made-for-export market in the social sciences. Right? It's the way in which people who don't do social science find out about what social science is. So when E.O. Wilson says he hates sociology, he hates Anthony Giddens, right? You know, and so there's a sense in which it's a very powerful kind of field, social theory, not necessarily because it guides social science's own development, but because of how it stands outside. And here it seems to me that we do need to take a kind of strong social science stand with regard to these developments that are happening in biology and society now, and the British tradition provides a kind of foundation for this. How much do I have any longer, or am I finished? A good 5 minutes. Okay, I don't want to go on longer than I need to. Now, one of the problems that I think we face, and I'm going to end by talking about some practical things, is that the readership for popular biology, you know, anything having to do with genetics and Darwinism and so forth, has never been better. It's never been higher. And in fact, a lot of social scientists read this stuff too, and increasingly you're seeing this stuff being cited, whether we're talking about people like Wilson, you know, or Richard Dawkins on the one hand, or on the other hand, you know, more cautious kind of critical people like Stephen Jay Gould or Stephen Rose, people of that kind. But one of the problems that we run into, it seems to me, is that social scientists are purely parasitic on this literature, right? In other words, we do not have our own views about evolutionary biology, about genetics and so forth. Yes, there are a lot of social scientists currently studying what people are doing, right? In the sociology of science, you know, we've got the sociology of health, we've got a lot of that kind of stuff going on. People studying what's happening in all these various medical decisions and so forth. And that's very important, of course. But what we don't have in the social sciences, as it were, is a social science understanding of these biological phenomena. We tend to take it off the shelf, and pretty much off the shelf in conformity with our prejudices, right? So, you know, sorts of people who already kind of liked Herbert Spencer will probably reach for the Richard Dawkins, right? People who held, you know, who are very much anti-biological determinists love reading Stephen Jay Gould or Stephen Rose or somebody like that, right? But and these people will be just cited as authorities. I mean, it is interesting the extent to which you see in our peer-reviewed journals in sociology how many popular books of biology get cited as evidence for things, right? So we'll be citing technical sociological works on matters in which, you know, we're expert and we know there are other experts around. But when we turn to the sciences, right, we just immediately cite the best-selling book, okay? In this sense, there's an uncritical appropriation of this material. And that's one thing that needs to be changed, it seems to me. That is to say that when we teach our students, both undergraduate and graduate students, we need to teach them how to engage with this subject matter directly, to deal with the experiments. You know, and one can start with a popular book. One can start, let's say, with Steven Pinker's The Blank Slate, which is one of my personal bugbears. And you can see the kinds of experiments and things that he talks about and what kinds of points he thinks are being proven by them. And you look in the footnotes and you look at, well, where did he get those experiments from? Go back to the journal, look at the articles, right, and compare them to what he says, and do a methodological critique. Do that as a pedagogical device, as a way. And there you can get a distinctive social science take on a lot of this stuff. Okay? And also look at the history of biology and the way it's constructed. It is not this kind of unified lockstep discipline that's a million miles away in its scientificity from social science. That is just a historiographical mirage. All right? That in fact the biology is just as contested as anything in the social sciences. We just don't know about it. There are many different views out there, and those differences can be exploited for our own purposes. Okay? But we need to re-engage with this stuff firsthand ourselves. Because in fact, that's what those biologists have done. If you read people like Pinker, you read people like E.O. Wilson, what they do with social science work, what they do is they strip off the theory and the method, and they just take the data, and then they slap on their own, you know, hyper-biological explanations. They especially love doing this on the qualitative work. Right? I mean, you know, where they could just, you know, anthropology, ethnographic work, and so forth. You know, you'll see, well, you know, these tribes do this, these tribes do that. We take five tribes from different parts of the world. Boom, we've got a generalization here. You go back to the original study, the data was collected under lots of different theoretical conditions, different constraints of all kinds that would make any kind of easy generalization very difficult to do. Right? So what they do is they engage with our material, oh, very well, all too well. They tear it apart, get rid of what's distinctively social scientific about it, and treat it as raw data for their own theories to cover. Okay? They don't take us as authorities on our stuff, and I don't see why we should take them as authorities when they're talking about our stuff. But so that's, it seems to me, from a practical standpoint, right, along with whatever kind of larger ideological campaign we might want to mount about reasserting the identity of social science, right, this is kind of at the nitty-gritty level where the argument has to be taken, that we just cannot let these easy generalizations fly. Okay? And it's not enough just to sort of, you know, snigger in the back and say, oh, look at this idiotic biologist trying to put together these things that have nothing to do with each other. Because people believe them. Okay? People believe them. And unless we publicly, you know, if we do not publicly engage these issues, nothing's going to change. And social science is just going to fade away, as theology did, from the front lines of academic research. And I think this would be a really big mistake, but it is one that is reversible. And with that, I'll stop here. Thanks. Okay, yes, I mean, yes, Dickens, his first name escapes me at the moment, the guy at Cambridge. What's his first name? Peter, that's it, Peter Dickens. If you're not familiar with who he's talking about, in that, you know, Concepts of the Social Sciences series, Open University Press puts out, he wrote the book on social Darwinism, which is a very good book. It is a very good book. Don't let that Spencerian title fool you. It's a very good book, what you're saying about him is absolutely right. Namely, he is a person who is trying to engage, you know, so show how, as it were, class-like phenomena can be reproduced biologically, right? But not in the sense of just genetic determinism, but looking how environment is in fact constraining the possibility you know, more certain kinds of reproductive patterns to occur. And he's drawing, to a large extent, on Conrad Waddington and all of those kind of left-wing social biology guys, you know, who did have some affiliation with Beveridge and the people at the LSC. He was at Edinburgh, Waddington. And so, yes, I mean, see, with someone like Dickens, yes, I think that that is, in fact, a very interesting way to go. I think the problem is it needs to be reconnected a little bit more with the history of social science, because I think at the moment, if you read his kind of stuff, it looks like, you know, kind of like the way some of Runciman's stuff looks like, anti-social science. It looks like, I mean, if you know Runciman's book, The Social Animal, which in a sense was meant to be a kind of introductory work that was kind of trying to show that there's human nature and biology to contend with. But you may know that there's like a couple, two or three chapters in that book where he's just scathing about social science as if it were, you know, he might as well have been E.O. Wilson writing it. So that kind of defeats the whole purpose in a sense, because it kind of, it leaves the reader with the impression you have to make some kind of choice. Like you either take the biology seriously or you do social science, but you can't do both. And I think this is the thing. I think it would be people like Dickens and others who want to pursue this line have to be, should be constantly reconnecting with the social science tradition in order for this to look persuasive to people. And that doesn't look like it's just, you know, anti-social science of another kind. But I agree with you. Now, with regard to Freud, yes, I think the historical Freud. The problem is, of course, you know, we've now got the postmodern Freud. Well, okay, yeah, that's true. There's him, yeah. But the point is that there are certain figures who you might say are kind of radioactive at the moment that are very hard to rehabilitate without bringing in all kinds of other issues. So if you want, you know, so I would, and I also think that the stuff like that Dickens is doing is probably more along the right lines, to be perfectly honest. That is to say, to be concerned with the population genetic side of this. Because it's going to be in those kinds of issues where the policy and the and our orientation about what the social is, who can be included, who's excluded, all the rest of it, it's going to be along those kinds of lines, it seems to me. So what those you know, left-wing genesis were talking about in the early decades of the 20th century are in fact the issues that we need to be re-engaging with now. Exactly right. No, yeah. You're exactly right on the Westermarck. There's a sense in which Westermarck, if you know Edward Westermarck, he is in a sense a man for our time on this issue.
Brilliant.
Yes.
Okay.
And he's the only social scientist E.O. Wilson cites positively in Consilience.
I'm not sure that's
the point. But that's an example of someone who was definitely thinking beyond the boundaries, as it were, and really trying to reconcile the social and the biological. So you're absolutely right on that point.
The point I'm making. It hasn't really brought that. It's been the anthropological tradition, the development of British sociology, but also in LSE. And just like Troy, I have to throw away a point. I don't know if I don't understand it, but if you're really looking for the first British sociologist, it's not Bill, it's Harry
Parker. Oh, right. Sure. Yeah.
Right, also, great in some figures.
That's true.
That notion of the cannibalization of the social coming from the Pinsker movement, the big direction, and you chiefly focused on the sort of biomedical.
That's right.
Could you say a little bit more about the humanistic one? Because I think most people in the audience didn't see themselves as sociologists. They'd probably be gung-ho about the biomedical approach. Maybe less so about the humanistic one, if it's got a postmodern twist to it. Could you elaborate a little bit on let's say, what you see as some of the main features of that sort of humanistic?
Okay. Part of what I'm talking about there, you know, it's interesting that Frank this morning was talking about the need to recover the subject and subjectivity, and he's right on that point, because what I mean by the humanistic side is the kind of anti-humanistic humanism, right, of the sort of postmodern condition, whereby one, in a way, kind of, if one talks about agency, one talks about it in a very flat kind of sense, where agency can be attributed to just about everything, because, you know, in classical In classical philosophy, agency was a very special kind of term, implying that one had a kind of animating, self-directing spirit, right? Teleology, right? That was a kind of key issue. But nowadays, and one would think that only certain animals and humans and so forth have it, if you're Aristotle, right? But nowadays, everything's got agency. So in a sense, the value of agency has been totally, deflated, okay? And indeed, the tendency has been death of the subject, death of the author, death of man, right? And human beings are talked about not as the masters or controllers or whatever of their fate, but as as Heidegger would say, the throne condition, right? We are subjected. We are right. So subjected becomes kind of a passive state, being subjected, especially after Foucault, right? And that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And my point here is that kind of view of human beings. It's quite compatible with biological perspective, it seems to me. Because basically you're not attributing any special kind of power, especially no power of transcendence to the human. Rather, the human is just, a subject to a certain kind of fate, a certain kind of condition, which one, of course, can understand, but there is no promise or hope or anything realizable about progress and all the rest of it. So that's kind of a key issue here, right? The breakdown of the human, right, the distinctiveness of the entity, of the human entity. Because remember, I think one thing that the biologists often don't appreciate fully, especially people like Pinker and Wilson, is that when you take the biological perspective deadly seriously in as a big evolutionary worldview, the idea of there being a distinctive human nature goes out the window. You just got nature, right? And it's just going to be a kind of cutoff point, as it were, by convention, where, as it were, things we call human versus non-human happen. Right, so look at issues having to do with disabilities, right? Look at issues having to do with what kinds of lives are worth living. There are enormous debates about these things at the moment on both ends, people coming into being and people going out of being. And what's the value of that versus other kinds of living creatures? This kind of debate has never been so lively before, and one of the things that it shows is that there is no longer any kind of clear intuition about where the integrity of the human lies. It just blurs into everything else. And in this respect, the postmodern condition and the biological perspective are very much in sync with each other.
Yeah.
It hasn't come out yet.
There's a lot in there. Okay, so we'll get back to you, don't worry. Yeah.
You were a little bit kind of concerned with the dangers of interdisciplinarity at the beginning, but towards the end, I was thinking, well, maybe sociologists are a little bit too kind of following the joke, but that we perhaps should be more kind of willing to engage. And that actually, sociologists have not got to say about the biological in the context of the post-genomic era.
Economics is the substratum of social life. No, right? And so in that respect, we have to incorporate genetics into sociology the way we have done with the economy and other sectors, you know, that could otherwise be studied as separate sciences in their own right. Okay, that's just, you know, I say a little bit more about that in the book, but it seems to me it's that kind of reconstruction of these disciplines that we need to do with sociologists, because in biology they don't hang together that well. These disciplines can be taken apart and reorganized in different ways. This is not physics. Okay, there is no unified theory of biology out there. Okay, and I think that's one of the great hopes that we have, that we can make some kind of difference here.